Okay, thank you, Hans. We'll have another go. As I say, we're on paper 9, and what we're looking for is comments or questions from you that we perhaps could discuss with the consultative group on Friday, that's a meeting. And we're using the same summary that you're using as the basis of some of our papers on and discussions on Friday. And just to highlight then some of the key points from the responses to the request for information, paragraphs 13 to 18 of Agenda Paper 9 mention these two broad types of rate regulation, cost of service, which was the main focus of the previous rate regulated project, and incentive based, which goes away from a cost plus basis, looking at building in different formulas. But the responses to the RFI suggest that's not helpful in terms of determining the scope of our project, because what we see is in all of the schemes that have been described in the responses, there are elements of both types. So some may be more based on cost of service than incentive, but they include some incentives. Others are more incentive-based, but still have an element of cost of service. So we thought it would be more helpful to look at other features of the rate regulatory schemes described. We did get 79 responses. They described aspects of rate regulation in 37 different countries, and also a variety of different industries. So we did take a quick look at the types of industries that might be covered. So paragraph 19 lists those. Some of them we would expect, so the main utilities, electricity, gas, water. A couple, though, that we didn't perhaps expect, certain types of insurance policies are covered by rate regulation. The provision of certain types of goods, such as fertilisers, in certain countries where those are considered very important. And what we saw was that the common feature of these is that they all seem to be essential goods, or what are called public goods or services. Looking at that, it means that when people are describing rate regulation and the main objectives to rate regulation, they often start by saying, well, it's a substitute for competition, because usually these public goods and services are provided by a monopoly provider or somebody near to monopoly. But when you look at the detail, it really isn't, the regulation really isn't a straight substitute for competition, because of the complex nature of the public service that's being provided. So in paragraph 23, we've summarised the main objectives that appear in almost all of the responses to the request for information as being the objectives of rate regulation. There is the price regulation, but also included in here is an objective to maintain or preserve the public service that's being provided. And it's that public nature of the service that creates lots of obligations for the rate-regulated entity that you wouldn't perhaps normally expect to see in a truly competitive market. The obligations are summarised mainly in paragraph 30, and they include requirements that relate to the level of service being provided, the quality of service being provided, the level of investment in the infrastructure as well is often included within the rate regulatory scheme. So it goes beyond just setting prices, it includes involvement in the investment programme of the rate-regulated entities as well. In addition, paragraphs 33 to 34, note that the rate-regulated entity cannot choose to cease or suspend or restructure or transfer its operations in a business combination or anything else without the approval of the rate regulator. And again, this is an added restraint or an added obligation on the rate regulated entity that you wouldn't normally expect if regulation was there just to be a substitute for competition. It's connected to this requirement to maintain the public service. Obviously, because there are so many obligations attached to being a provider of a public service, there are also lots of rights that accompany the rate regulation, which again, you wouldn't normally expect to see in a truly competitive market. Those rights are summarised in paragraphs 28 to 29 and 31 to 32. And typically in the schemes described in the responses, usually there's an exclusive right to provide the regulated goods or services in a geographical area. So it's a monopoly or a near monopoly situation in almost all cases. Sometimes the monopoly is created by a specific license or an agreement such as a service concession arrangement, which also triggers thoughts about IFRIC 12 and the interaction there. Sometimes the monopoly is created through natural barriers. So, for example, if you've got electricity transmission, you require the transmission infrastructure and it'd be difficult to put lots of electricity pylons throughout the country with having lots of different suppliers. So it's often just the geography or something about the infrastructure, the high level of capital investment that creates a monopoly. But in most of those situations, that natural type of monopoly is also enhanced by rate regulation that's built on top of it to maintain that public service. Noted in paragraph 31, the rate regulation then supporting this monopoly usually gives a right to the entity which is enforced by the law or the regulation to have the opportunity to recover their prudently incurred costs and some sort of rate of return on the investment, some sort of profit. However, the actual amount of cost recovery and profit that's made does depend very much on the type of regulation in force, the demand for the product, which can change, and also what rate of return is deemed to be reasonable. So it's not always a guaranteed return, but there should be an opportunity to earn some sort of return. To support this right, the regulatory schemes described in the responses to the request for information, without exception, all include some element of tracking variances from estimated amounts to actual amounts. And this applies in more incentive-based schemes as well as cost of service schemes. And this system to track, it's noted in paragraph 32, many of the respondents think that this tracking system of these variance accounts gives a greater assurance of recovery or reversal because there are various mechanisms then built into the regulation that allows further adjustments to try and make sure these amounts are either recovered or reversed. Those different mechanisms are summarised in paragraphs 40 to 43. By far the most common mechanism highlighted there is an adjustment to the future prices that can be charged for future goods and services that are sold. Some of these are very short-term and very specific adjustments to prices, which are often highlighted on bills to customers. So when they're getting their bills, it could only be over a 3-month period or a 12-month period. There's a separate line item on the bill that highlights this is an adjustment because of past under-recovery or over-recovery by the supplier. Other adjustments, though, is a general adjustment to the price over the next review period that could be anything from 12 months to 8 years, I think is the longest I've seen on these schemes, which is one of the things that raised problems in the previous project as to whether this does create an asset or a liability. But we didn't ask that question in the request for information. We just wanted to find the facts about the different types of schemes. And one of the things that we're going to do on Friday in the consultative group is see if we can use these facts to define the scope and to give us some direction for developing a discussion paper on this project. So at this point, I'll stop and open up the floor for any comments or questions.
Thank you. Jane, this is a wonderful paper. Very, very informative, very clear. The only thing I don't find at this stage in the analysis is two things. And maybe you didn't ask the question that may need to be pursued a little bit. Is how material are the amounts involved in terms of deferral accounts, balances that are carried over, or, and so are we talking about really material matters or is it just marginal? And the second is whether or not there is really a perceived need for specific accounting guidance beyond what we have today in our standards. I understand that most of the responses came from preparers. We don't seem to have any, well, very few from users, actually, beyond the regulators who are special users and do require a special reporting. But this is non-general purpose financial reporting. They require special, I guess, special forms, special filings to support the claims for rate regulation adjustments. This is non-GAAP, this is not non-financial, not general purpose. So the need for financial accounting guidance is not explicit from this paper, and I hope that in discussing with the group, you can further inform me for the purpose of making our agenda decision next September, whether really there is a perceived need to have in the financial statements for general purposes, special accounting for that. It may seem to be obvious a little bit from the analysis, but not knowing how material it is and how people are communicating with users, and also taking into account the fact that this regulation system is not new. It's been there for years, for ages, and companies have been reporting for ages. So do they have a big problem today that we need to solve urgently or not? That's my need to understand before we can make this agenda decision to embark on a relatively heavy project, because my feeling on that basis is that this project is not an easy one. It's a lot of work.
On the materiality issue, obviously most of the evidence that we've got is from countries where they currently have a local GAAP that allows or requires the recognition of these deferral balances. And certainly what we've seen there is some of them are very material. We're talking billions of dollars in North America, Canada, and the USA. We didn't specifically ask the question in the RFI, which is why it's not in this paper. But
I'm aware of Canada, but the USA, I would say, don't care much, in a way, because they're not going to apply this guidance. unless there are entities operating in this activity in the USA which are consolidated by groups which report under IFRS.
Certainly, I'd note that I think rate regulated entities in the US are very interested in this project and shown a great deal of interest. You asked about the need for guidance. I recall that this was an area that's featured in the response to the agenda consultation, which is really obviously why we've put it onto the board's agenda. So based on that, I think we've got the message that there are, you know, people do tell us this is an important area to develop guidance on.
Is there a way we can, at some point, later on, hear a little bit more from users? Specialist analysts who are using financial statements, what specific needs they have when looking at regulated activities?
At the meeting that we've got on Friday, the consultative group, we have got two analyst members of that consultative group, and we will be, we do have a session that we booked for an hour to try and gather more information on that. But yeah, I agree, it's a very important feature.
Jane, if I could just add something. On materiality, Philippe, I was asking that question initially. The one example I can give you is pensions. So I saw an example where the regulator only allows as a cost the cash paid for pensions. So if you're a startup, nuclear plant or something like that, you won't pay out much cash in pensions for, say, 20 years. But over that whole 20 years, the liability will be building, and they take up an asset to cover it for when they do have to. So that can be a very, very large and growing figure. And the need for guidance, I think, was mainly based on diversity of reporting. Some people are taking assets and liabilities. I mean, as you say, 34 countries you found, 37, there are rate regulated. And in some they're taking up assets and some they're not. So that was...
I agree with that, Andres. We don't have much feedback from users, whether what kind of adjustment that forces them to do. Do they have really any problem in comparing utilities in different countries? What kind of problem they have?
Sure.
Could I address that right now, very briefly? Some months ago, I think I sent to Jane, I think I sent to the rest of the board too, the rating methodology that Moody's uses for this sector for public and electric utilities. And they have four or five factors that they basically run through a model. I'm looking at it right now. They assign a 25% weight to the issue of ability to recover costs and earn returns in their assessment of the rating of a utility. And I'll just read from you briefly why it matters. This is their analysis. They say the ability to recover prudently incurred costs in a timely manner is perhaps the single most important credit consideration for regulated utilities, as the lack of timely recovery of such costs has caused financial stress for utilities on several occasions. For example, in four of the six major investor-owned utility bankruptcies in the United States over the last 50 years, regulatory disputes culminated in insufficient or delayed rate relief for the recovery of costs and or capital investment in utility plant. Then it goes on to say that the criteria we consider include the statutory protections that are in place to ensure full and timely recovery of prudently incurred costs. In its strongest form, these statutory protections provide unquestioned recovery and preclude any possibility of legal or political challenges to rate increases or cost recovery mechanisms. So anybody, I guess, who is analyzing these entities, I guess, is placing a lot of weight on the...
I'm surprised it is only 25%.
Yeah.
It should be much more. But it doesn't tell me that there is a need to put that on the balance sheet as an asset or liability per se.
I'm not arguing that point. I'm just saying, you know, why does it matter and does it matter? Apparently it matters a lot.
Yes.
Another just anecdotal evidence that I had just chatting with an analyst recently is that a lot of investors will invest in utilities where they're looking for a steady dividend stream or a steady cash flow, because the regulation, one of the things it does is it smooths out the impact of fluctuations, and that's something that, again, I'm told that analysts are looking for and are looking for more information that would give them more predictive value about the likelihood of future cash flows.
I want to ask you about the timing of the project. You know, we plan to publish DP end of this year. And based on this paper, I feel just like Philippe said, you know, it will be very, very challenging. The reason are the follows. You know, the current U.S. requirement establishes 97 days under the environment. There is a direct link. You know, the transaction is so simple most of the time. Of course, during that time, there are big, you know, utilities, but many entities will face very simple transactions. There is direct link. This is why I discussed with Propector several times. Propector always feel, we'll go, why not? I worked a long time ago somewhere, but that is a very small environment, and you can apply a particular rate changes because of particular event. There is a direct link. And then we start with the project, focus on cost base and cost recovery. In 2009, we fell, and because of different views. But another reason, as I understand, what we propose is based on expected notion, which is very complicated, which I feel may not be the ones current utility entities would like, because it's different from their accounting based on regulatory decision. And now, based on this paper, it seems the scope further broadened. Now, first, the not only cost-based, but incentive-based, and more. You basically said there's very, very rare case it will be pure cost-based, and more incentive-based. Secondly, you know, there are so many entities who come in and say that I'm subject to the regulatory regimes, and some of them will not cover in 2009, including healthcare, postage, and port, and the airport. Who else? You know, so many. If we want to cope all these entities, it becomes much wider. And thirdly, in the last DD, we already noticed the problem. This is why we use expected. That is, you know, the late decision is not based on actual amount. It's based on something expected or industry average, and also there is a timing gap, and there is a possibility a big utility company like British Gas or anything else have so many lines of business. And quite often the case, the rate changes will depend on not only one line of business. The rate regulators will approve something based on different factors. And in China, I'm not sure whether in other countries, big rate changes have to go through public hearing.
Yep.
And so this is sort of the difficulties. And last one, I feel interesting in your paper, you know, the regulations, the laws impose the company not only one liability, that is what amount you can charge, but there are many other social obligations and in addition to the rate. And if we want to integrate all those complicated factors, I'm not sure, you know, whether you can provide a DP by the end of this year. Originally, I think about 3 years ago, and Michael summarized by the end, said there are four alternatives. Do nothing, disclose only, recognize as an intangible asset, and lastly, go ahead based on expected notion. I'm not sure, you know, with such a broad, you know, complicated things, and what the alternative will be in your mind, which will come out within half a year. Jen.
Yeah, how long is this string? I mean, yeah, publishing by the end of this year, I think, is an extremely ambitious project. And even at this stage now, I am concerned how far we're going to get. I think a lot of research has been done, and the request for information provides a lot of information. But I do think now, if we can focus the discussion on Friday's meeting as well and really clarify how much of this topic we want to deal with. And there are various options, but I think in the past it didn't progress because we weren't quite sure what aspects of rate regulation we were actually focusing on, because there was an emphasis on this cost of service and a direct link, cause and effect, between the costs incurred and the price charged. And certainly my feeling now is to shift away from that and to break it down into, can we see other elements that have the potential for us to develop some guidance? Philippe asked the question, you know, do people feel that they need it? And I think the answer to that is yes. Another pertinent question is it possible to provide it? And that's something I think that we can address relatively short term. The answer to that will then dictate how long it takes us to get the discussion paper out, because how much do we want to tackle?
I'll give you one simple example. I won't stop. You know, in any country, you know, big utility charges will be very, very critical. And a particular government wants to maintain its power, will promise, you know, will not change, you know. This is more liability, you know. You know, government imposed the utility company not change the rate. It's your liability. And maintain current service. You mentioned it in your paper. And should accounting system we design also take into consideration of such obligation? Purely because of political reason.
But don't we take that sort of thing into account with impairment reviews as well? You know, that there are those sorts of complications
Yeah, of course. As I said, if we come out a very complicated, expected-based accounting system, this will be different from their current practice. and then this, whether this will be the ones they want.
Well, I mean, one of the things I was following with the conceptual framework discussions in terms of some of the issues about recognition, does it become so complicated to measure something that we end up deciding not to recognise it at all? And that is a possible outcome of this project, but obviously it's a question we've got to go through.
I think we should not prejudge those things right now. I think we should focus on Friday, what is the scope, and deal with it. And I think Vegu's fears are well placed, but I think it's a little premature because we are putting the cart before the horse or whatever you want to call it. I think we need to think about Friday, how do we scope it, then move to the next step. But I think his points are valid. I'm smiling when Vegu is talking because I feel like Vegu is preparing another dissent here.
before I retire.
Jiangwu?
Thank you. Just a short, there are two users who are their comments about the, is there any special things? User's response.
Oh, sorry, within the...
Yeah, within.
The response is here,
users.
The user responses were really focused, I think, on gathering the information, and they're very much influenced by do they already work in an environment where these things are recognised, and that really reflects the previous responses to the 2009 ED. People that are familiar with US GAAP or similar that see these things think that it's vital information in the financial statements. Those users that don't get it in the financial statements will look to alternatives to try and use that information. And one of the things that we do want to find out is how much information is needed and is viable to contain within, as Philippe says, general purpose financial statements, because some user responses as well are from the regulators that do see themselves as valid users of financial statements, but obviously we have a different definition of user, for which is the general purpose financial statement.
Same line with Wego. After reading your paper, I have a fear of scope creep, because in your paper, many people said that we should establish a broad principle so that the broad range of rate regulation to be covered. So actually, in each jurisdiction, in many industries, they are regulated somehow. So once we say we are going to start rate regulation, and somebody said we should be in the scope, then the other would say, if that industry would be in the scope, my industry could be in the scope. So such kind of scope creep we should avoid. So perhaps in the very early stage of the project, we should not let them mount the too much expectation. That is very important. And when we talk about this rate regulation, rate regulated industries accounting standard, I think really principle itself is important. Core principle is really important because as you've shown in your paper, there are a variety of industries. So the name of industry doesn't really matter. Perhaps the important thing is nature of the restriction. And Philip and others pointed out a very good suggestion. Our target is to make a general purpose financial statement. And each jurisdiction have their own industry-specific accounting local rule, which is only for the purpose of regulation. So we should not commingle all these purposes. So we have to make clear that our standpoint is to make the general purpose financial statement. And in order to achieve this general purpose financial statement, the core principle of rate regulation is this and this, and make it clear in the earlier stage of this project.
Yeah, thank you.
Does the Japanese GAAP have the rate regulation?
Yeah, quite a lot. And actually, Japan has not adopted IFRS yet. And Japanese GAAP has a, we have a general purpose GAAP. However, say ministry like Ministry of Industry, they have their own ordinance. And it includes something like rate regulated purposes. But to some extent, it is utilized for general purposes, financial statements. So it's quite difficult to tell one thing from another.
Right.
I mean, in some industry, this financial statement is used for the regulatory purposes and then general purposes as well. And the principle is not very transparent. And same thing could be said to any other countries as well, I guess. So this is the difficult area to get in.
Mary?
I think it's important that we're going ahead with this long-term project. I think the cautions that we've heard from everybody are important, and maybe in Friday's meeting also important to convey to the participants, because I think what we're hearing is that we have to understand what IFRS stakeholders need from about rate-regulated accounting. And when you talk about users, I think what we've heard a lot of people say is, understand what they find most useful and then figure out how that should be provided. It might be recognition, it might not be. It might be disclosure, might be supplemental information. And what we have to do is avoid a presumption that because we're starting with a project, the only answer it can come up with is a special model that is based on capitalizing variance accounts. And that, that the work that we do on scope is really important because it is about understanding what the needs are of users. But I think there's also a need of preparers and others that we've got to answer with this project, which is to clarify once and for all how the standards apply when they intersect with rate-regulated activities, and what it means to apply IFRS to those entities. We've done that in bits and pieces, and the Interpretations Committee has, but there's a lot of concern about whether that's the authoritative view. So I think that's the other thing we'll do in a project, and the fact that we're doing a project is not an automatic, and the end result will be a special model. So that's got to be a message that we carry forward quite strongly. I think one thing that struck me preparing for Friday's meeting, for this board meeting, and thinking about the project is how fast we proceed. I think this long-term project is a priority project, but I think there are two things I'm realizing about our proposal for an interim project. One is it does take some of the pressure off in terms of those who see lack of specific guidance on rate regulators being a barrier to adopting. But two, it also, if it goes ahead, provides, I think, a real opportunity to answer maybe some of Philippe's questions about how material is the impact and how do users use the information because of the segregation that it proposes for deferral accounts on both the asset and liability side. And more as I think about the interaction of this long-term project with our conceptual framework project, I think there's some interesting interactions. But we may, as we start progressing with this, maybe want to let the conceptual framework project get a bit further along before reaching any definitive conclusions, which means that maybe in the next 12 months we should look again at how ambitious our time frame is for this. Not delay for the sake of it, but think about where we need to be on conceptual framework versus this long-term project. Those are some thoughts about timing, but I think in the immediate, it's going back to the initial meetings and clear communication about what our objectives are for this project, and that's to understand the needs of different stakeholders for information about rate-regulated activities and how best to satisfy that.
Just a comment on the interim standard. People who opposed this doing the interim standard mainly had two reasons. One, they thought then we wouldn't deal with the major problem quickly enough. And two, they presumed that we knew what the answer was. Mm-hmm. And whenever I was speaking to constituents, I always point out that this shouldn't slow. You know, they can point to insurance, for instance, where we did an interim standard or exploration. It shouldn't slow the thing. And secondly, there is no presumption of what the answer is because we did an interim standard. But I'd be cautious about slowing down too much.
Yeah, too much, yeah. But as we say, when we look at this, you know, I don't know if it was Philippe, but then Jane commented, getting a discussion paper out in Q4, Q1 is pretty ambitious.
Martin?
After having read this paper, I think scope is key, and maybe the consultative group should first focus on scope. And maybe one idea, because if this information about this rate regulated referral balances are so relevant, I'm wondering, because it is not required under IFRS, but isn't all these companies or industry are providing a kind of non-GAAP information already to that, and have we done research? Who is doing that? Is it different for the different schemes? So if you have cost-based or incentive-based, do companies really in their reporting to analysts in the analyst packages report differently about that? So the overall question is, can we learn already from the non-GAAP information these companies or different industry provides to investors how really important it is for different industries and maybe also for different kind of schemes? Because my understanding is, even if an accounting standard doesn't provide it, but if investors really want to have it, as Pat said, and maybe 25% of their overall valuation is based on that, I would wondering if really the companies do not on a regular basis provide this information already to analysts and investors, and do we have done sufficient research to understand what's currently reported.
Gary?
Just reading this paper, Jane, sort of brings you back. I had two very large public utility clients decades ago, Pricewaterhouse, and brought back some memories of things I haven't thought about in about 30 years. A couple of comments, and I agree with my colleagues' comments about scope, and I'm not sure how many of these are for Friday's meeting versus for consideration discussion paper, is I think, public utilities authorities, that set the rates. They're broadly another regulator, and I'm thinking about, the financial regulators. They tend to have views of what bank financial statements should look like, and we try to keep to more of a general model. They'll have views on what is hedging, what is capital, and so on, the financial regulators. So the question I think we should probably consider is, why would public utility regulators be different than, say, banking regulators? They are regulators, they got statutory authorities, all those things, but again, it's a difference with no distinctions, maybe it's important. I would wonder, this may be for the group on Friday, is although you got these deferred accounts, it could be an asset, it could be a liability, is it worth considering, would some of those qualify to be an asset under a general GAAP type view, under matching, or are they just PP&E or a prepaid or something like that, such that although it's viewed as a regulatory asset or liability, maybe it would qualify under some other theory, no one just ever thought about it like that, which if that's the case, that would take some of the itch, off the table.
But I think that's the question, Gary. Some countries, they think they do qualify as assets and liabilities under the framework or under the standards. In other countries, they don't.
No, I know that. And I think, but under IFRS, would they qualify under some other standard, to be an asset?
That's the question that we're tackling in the project.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's within the scope of our organization's charter, but some of these are investor-owned. And some would be government-owned, but the government-owned ones themselves might have publicly traded bonds. And I don't know if that isn't, I can assure you they do, from my own experience. And then lastly, and scope is key, and I really don't want to add to the scope, but as I'm looking at the entity, the type of entities you listed, transit authorities, postal services, insurance, got me thinking. why wouldn't like hospitals then be in scope? Like a hospital, or their beds would be regulated, you know, by the healthcare commissions and stuff like that, and you know, same thing with nursing homes and so on. So if you hadn't listed postal services and insurance, it probably wouldn't occur to me and kept it to public utilities. But if we're branching out, I think, you know, the medical system.
A lot of health services, yeah, certain aspects.
Are heavily regulated for rates.
Yeah. What about certain banks? Isn't it a certain banking activity?
Yeah, I did get a communication recently that mentioned, it wasn't specifically in response to this, but it mentioned there are certain banks or financial institutions that have to provide loans to certain categories of members of the public at lower interest rates than they would normally do, because you know it's government policy to try and help out that particular part of the population. So the more you look into this and the more you just chat with people, the more things seem to come through.
I think you've got to find a way to draw a line after C or D or something, you know, it'll never get done.
I would love it if we could come away from industry types and to something that's specific a regulation, and then we're not looking at doing industry specific guidance. It's something specific in the rights and obligations or the way that regulation works that's common across the board. Whether it's achievable, I don't know, but
if I'm a deposit-taking bank, deposits, the rate I pay on those deposits are fixed by government. Does it make it a rate-regulated activity in a way? And we had the discussion, or you had discussion about classification and measurement, when you don't follow the benchmark rate, and government intervenes heavily and tells you how much you can charge, how much you can pay. So I think we will have a decision to make to restrict the scope, as you said, to go online and say, okay, we're not going to deal on a principle basis with everything which has some form of regulation, because everything in many countries is regulated to a certain extent.
Okay.
I think it brings back to me a discussion we had, the small group or the board advisors had, on this, what is in the scope of regulation. I think virtually any company, any organization working in an economy which is to have some part of it, in India, drugs are controlled. In South Africa and all, the AIDS-related drugs are highly regulated. So if you go down that, but I think what we need to think about is not just, and this is something we need to think about on Friday and further, is not just somebody regulating it. That's virtually everybody comes into the picture, banks, insurance, healthcare, everything. But the second aspect of it is quite important in my mind. If there is a rate regulation, what is the mechanism for those companies to recover the cost? So otherwise, everybody is in rate regulation.
Yeah.
You know, in India, there is an issue now. Airlines cannot sell seats, the preferred seats, beyond six, more than six. So they regulate it. So you can choose your seat. Only six of the in every aircraft, you can sell it for a higher price. Rest of it should be given to public. That's the rate regulation. So you can think about it. But the second aspect is very important. How do the regulation allow them to recover any cost? That's what we need to think about.
That would be a good narrowing or at least a scope down.
Otherwise, we are thinking about everybody.
Yes.
No. It becomes a general purpose entity with a footnote disclosure.
Now, PK, this actually, my understanding is related to the other side, that is the quantity. And the original U.S. GAAP, as I said, based on some kind of direct relationship, you know, but as we, you know, have already seen in the past ED, whether you can easily, you know, detect such kind of direct relationship, you know, let's assume you fix the price, but actually not fix, you have incentive scheme, but the other side, the quantity itself is not, you know, so easily determined. That makes it so complicated.
Did Weigu agree to come on Friday, or has he chose to abstain?
No.
I'm afraid, Weigu...
Don't ask me as an enemy, you see. Don't ask me as an enemy.
There was no specific invitation, as he's not one of our specific board advisors, but he would be very welcome.
I think it will be very helpful if you participate and see what is happening there. It will be helpful. So
Observe.
Did you receive sufficient warnings, Jane?
I think, yeah, I mean, I think all of the points are valid, and I'm in a way pleased that everybody agrees that, you know, scope is so critical, and it's one of the things that's been delaying progressing, actually developing the discussion paper, because it could be 1,000 pages, which definitely wouldn't happen by Christmas, but that would just be too big. So thank you very much for your comments, and I'm sure we'll raise quite a few of them. I'm looking at Patricia, who's chairing the session on Friday, but we'll make sure that these concerns are communicated to the consultative group, and we'll update you in September, when no doubt I'll be sat here again and we'll talk about it some more.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Then, tea break?
No.
Oh, yeah, that's what's on the agenda.
Yeah, this one.
Okay.
The,